Well, this morning I awoke a little earlier because my daughter woke up, 6-month-old daughter woke up a little early and needed some attention. And so while I had her up and I turned on the BBC World News, and as I saw that, I heard the tale of the Ivory Coast. There we have two rivals who both claim victory in their recent presidential elections. Which took place all the way back on November 28th, and it was the first such election in over 10 years. Laurent Gbagbo has been president since 2000 when he was elected, and now, backed by the Homeland sort of Constitutional Court and, of course, the armed forces, Gbagbo's claiming victory. His opponent, Alassane Ouattara, has been pronounced victorious by the UN Elections Commission, and he has the support of the surrounding African nations and much of the West, which is probably where part of the problem comes in, as far as most of the country's concerned. Well, now Gbagbo's assets, along with all of his family's, have been frozen and they can't get to them. It's bringing a great deal of pressure to bear on him. And Ouattara is holed up himself, besieged in a hotel, surrounded by 800 UN troops and tanks. They're protecting him from the other forces. The West African Regional Body, ECOWAS, is seeking mediation to end the conflict peacefully, but they have not foregone the possibility of a special forces raid to forcibly remove Gbagbo. Of course, in the streets, the people of the Ivory Coast are not just watching with detached interest. Unrest has filled the streets. Protests by the opposition has led to curfews and heightened police and security patrols. Foreigners are being threatened and attacked. The division between tribes and ethnic groups is growing. Over 100 people have been killed in the streets. The main cash crop, cocoa, is not moving into the commercial capital since the producers are afraid that the crop will be destroyed in the midst of riots. In a country that had once been sort of the model of African stability, a prosperous country, relatively speaking, what is now being sought is power. And that power and control is held by a very fine thread. At any moment, it might snap and plunge the nation into civil war. Of course, we might be tempted to look at the Ivory Coast and think that the problem really only resides there, that the African continent is so full of problems: poverty, tribal forces, colonial influences run amok, HIV, drought, poor resources, that really any amount of governance is too light a cure. Aspirin, when what you need is really the heavy-duty antibiotics. But the reality that we face is that anywhere there is power to be wielded, there are going to be those who strive after it. Even in our mostly peaceful nation, seats of power are fought over. Our recent midterm elections were so nasty and uncivil because people saw power at stake. Misused power in most eyes, power wrongly appropriated by the government, or power bought by large corporations. And language that's employed by radicals of all sorts begins to sound frighteningly revolutionary, treasonous. But that's the way it is in the halls of power. If you have it, you'll work to hold on to it for dear life. And if you don't have it, you go after it using every trick you possibly can. It's nothing new. Not in the least. It reaches far back into our history. People want power and will do everything to get it, and sometimes even more. Now, we do have to say a positive word about power for a moment. God does, in fact, grant us authority and power to help maintain order in our society. God grants all communities an ability to wield power to keep control, allowing us to live in peace. Unfortunately, fallen human creatures that we are, we want more than what we've been given. We seek to put ourselves at the top of the heap, a heap usually consisting of the poor souls that we've climbed over to get to the top and those that we have to keep kicking down so we can stay there. We might want to blame it just on power itself. After all, we all know the saying, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. But the problem really isn't the power. The problem is that human beings and our institutions are corrupted by the power of sin. We don't live in the wholeness that God intended for us. The fallen world is and always has been rife with discord. We don't live in the relationships with one another as we should. By choosing something other than what God desired for us, human beings launched the world into a downward spiral. Murder, theft, infidelity, covetousness, insurrection, greed, revenge, and on and on and on. No matter how much technology or philosophical wrangling we might undergo, we still go after power like a moth towards a flame. Herods we are, the lot of us. And Herod the Great is our typical ruler here. He is the king of the Jews, and he was not above low-down tactics to keep himself there. Of course, Israel figured he was probably better than having the whole force of the Roman Empire sitting down on top of them. So they let him be. They kept things calm. So, when the three wise men appeared out of nowhere asking for help to find the king of the Jews who had been born, Herod and all of the people were unnerved. Another king? How do you know? Well, star has appeared. Even the fixed heavens respond to this new king. Surely he must be great. So Herod asks his scribes, where is the Messiah to be born? In Bethlehem. Herod seeks his own end, of course. He dispatches these wise men to find the new rival king for him. And then he will dispatch this new king, this new rival, rather quickly. With her unwitting help. Herod refuses to let go of his power, and he will bring death to keep it. This fallen world, this broken and sinful place where rulers seek their own end, is the world into which Jesus is born. But Jesus doesn't enter this world as just one other power competing with them. He comes as the power that brings about the end of these subordinate powers. And this goes over so well with the worldly powers. Herod the Great, Herod Antipas, his son, Pilate, Caesar. In the end, they all collude to bring about his death. Their myopic view allows them only to see Jesus' power as worldly political power. Herod and Pilate attempt to deal with Jesus as if he were claiming the throne of Israel, which he is, but not the way they think. And here in the visit of the Magi, do we see the foreshadowing of Jesus' end? Death of the children in and around Bethlehem, and spices for burial. Yet this one that the Magi bow down before is not just another power. Jesus is not a rival in the same sense. While Jesus is the Son of God, he has emptied himself of the glory and power that is proper to him as God. He empties himself and takes on a feeble human frame and is instead armed with one and only one power that will not fry that fleshly existence. The only power Jesus comes with is love. Love that is meant for the lost sheep of Israel, but also draws the nations to him. This love is the love that spun out the galaxies and stars and the grand laws of the universe. This love is the love that Jesus will use to still the winds and quiet the storms. This love is the love that will heal the sick and bind up the brokenhearted. This love puts an end to the sin that corrupts everything it touches. And this love brings hope to the whole world, rippling out from Israel, reverberating in the prophet Isaiah's words, "Nations shall come to your light and kings to the brightness of your dawn." Jesus will be the full and complete restoration of Israel, bringing about the promise of the Abrahamic covenant, where the nations, the Gentiles, will be blessed through the people of God's restoration. Jesus' kingship is unlike any earthly kingship. He does not wield power to control and force people into line. But we see in Jesus one who establishes his kingdom by taking all of the anger and the hatred and the violence and the death that are thrown at him. And rather than return it tit for tat, he takes it on and suffers for our sake so that all of it might be destroyed. This love then seeks to reclaim us so that we might, with the wise men, bow down, pay homage and worship him, not as a people who have been forced to their knees, but as those who freely and willingly bow down and submit ourselves to the love that has been shown. This love calls us to participate in the community of love that stands against the sinful powers of this world and all that they corrupt. And we, of course, witness to this love breaking bread and drinking wine as this love continues to come into our world, continues to come to us and transform us. Thanks be to God. Amen.